we've been kind of talking to Jan about doing Dave's thing for quite a while, and she managed to get a little bit of funding from the CGP local community fund for us to come and have a look at the church. So we came up with an idea of what we were going to do, which was to look at the outside of the church building to look to see if we could find any interesting inscriptions and stones. And part of the reason we discussed this and thought it sounded like a good idea was because of what's been found before, which Robert's already mentioned. But if you've got the next one. During the renovation of the 1930s, there were quite a few interesting bits and pieces that were found. I just said to Jan, I'd love to have been here when they took those walls down in the 1930s. I'm sure they must have just dumped loads of interesting things or just put them back into the walls. Probably, if we could take the walls down again, if you fancy doing that, then we'll see what they left behind, because undoubtedly they would have missed things. And all what they found were more interesting bits that presumably the builders and the vicars who owned the bit at the time that happened to spot. And it's one of these annoying things about these renovations of churches, is it's very, very hit and miss what was found and what wasn't. So obviously it depends on who was on site. And obviously some vicars were very interested in the subject, as we've already heard. And I'm going to be here probably daily paying attention to what was found. Sometimes you have a very interested building foreman who's paying attention, or an architect who's paying attention. And sometimes the actual people doing the building work would probably spot things because they would be paying close attention. Other times you get the impression that no one was paying any attention at all. And they did an enormous amount of work and nothing's ever turned up. Which is why when you see these, if you look at the books on the subject, there's distribution maps of where different things are being found. You have to take into account that that's very random. In that in some places where, I mean, my church in Ulverston had 7 rebuildings, never been anything found. Now, is it just no one was paying any attention, or is it just generally nothing there? So that is a problem. Anyway, I digress, which I probably will do quite a lot. So we knew about these stones, obviously. These are the pictures from Frank Warriner's article that he wrote in 1931 about the bits that were found. This is the cross head, which, if we go outside, you'll see in the wall. I'm sure you've probably all seen it already. It's still there. Another slightly unfortunate side effect of some of these discoveries was that the Victorians in particular used to think the best thing to do with these things, if you found them in the rubble, was to build them into the wall, which is great, but except now we can't see the side of that, we can only see that bit. Now there might be something on the back, but obviously we'll never know unless we chisel that out of the wall now and remove all the cement from it. So if you do find one of these, please, please do not stick it back in the wall. So this is the crosshead. The display we nearly saw had quite a nice reconstruction where they actually showed where it would be. If you imagine one of these big stone crosses, that would be right at the top. It's a box at the middle. This little hole here probably would have held a paste stone or even semi-precious stone, and that would have had arms coming out. This is all the interlaced, not the design that's typical of that period, and that's thought to be 11th century, so 1000, so pre Norman Conquest, which in this part of the world is quite significant and fairly rare. Next one. And obviously the better well-known Franciscan cross, which has what's called a cable rope down the side, so it's kind of twisted to look like string or cable, and then this kind of interlaced design on the inside. And that would have been a fairly substantial panel of stone on this cross, which it's a big thing, it's not insubstantial. And this kind of pattern is very, very common across the kind of whole of this region, in the Norse period. This is thought to be 10th to 11th century, so maybe slightly later, or slightly earlier, sorry. But a style that's seen all the way across the sort of north of England into the south of Scotland, the Isle of Man, numerous sites with this kind of similar material. Again, I would love to have seen what's on the other side and what's on this edge in particular, but unfortunately not possible. And then the other thing you can see inside the church, next slide, which is the what the people refer to as the Antef stone, because it says Antef on it, which is now in the corner above the little niche in the corner. This is again a photograph from 1930 when it was found. Suggested at the time by W.G. Collingwood, I'm sure many of you have heard of, as being a Roman inscription. Certainly the text is kind of Roman style, the lettering is Roman style. It's a bit big for a Roman inscription, it's a bit crude, it's not well done with some of them. He suggested it might be part of a bigger inscription that said something like Curante Flavio, but there's a big problem with that in that F, there's nothing else after the F, it just stops there. So how how he managed to work out that he might say Flake and the letters. I'm not entirely sure. And Roger Tomlin, who's like the leading authority on Roman inscriptions now, is very adamant that's not a Roman inscription at all. It's not right for Roman at all. I'll come back to that. So we knew there were bits and pieces of interest, obviously. We thought maybe it'd be worth looking to see if we could find anything else. And I'm just having a general, as far as I'm aware, no one's ever done a sort of systematic look at the building, particularly. Bits and pieces have been found, bits and pieces have been identified. Just reading Robert's book now, there's bits mentioned in there that we saw when we were going around. There has been work looking at Mason's Marks, which is the next slide, which is again something in the 19th into the early 20th century. A lot of antiquarians started investigating Mason's Marks, so there's quite a lot of recorded examples at Furness Abbey, where there's hundreds and hundreds of different examples. Calder Abbey, there's quite a few recorded there, and other sites as well. And so these are the kind of things you'll sometimes find. Now, I'm a bit debatable, are these just lines of Mason's Marks? But anyway, but some of the other ones are the kind of things you'll find. And Mason's Marks were, the stonemasons marked their work because they got paid on piece of work, basically. So every finished stone they did, they got paid for that completed piece. They marked their signature on each stone, basically, so they could say, that's mine, and everyone knew how many they'd done. A lot of them aren't visible because they're hidden in the joints or hidden behind the back of the stonework, but one or two are visible. And I suspect most of them are inside somewhere. I don't think the council actually says where they are, annoyingly, just sort of says these are some examples. It doesn't actually map out where they are in the building. So it's another reason why I thought it was worth doing this very systematic look around to see if we could identify anything else of interest. So the idea was we'd do this with volunteers, led by myself, and unfortunately helped by some very capable helpers and very capable volunteers. And we did it over 2 weekends. I think the first one was in June or July, and it was part of that very warm bit in the summer, so it was a lovely day, nice and sunny, we're quite lucky. The second part we ended up not getting to until September, and fortunately it was still a nice day that day as well, not too bad actually. So what we actually did, if you go to the next one, we basically walked around systematically as we could with the volunteers on the first weekend, looking at all the external walls and all the external stone and seeing what we could identify. Now, obviously we can't say we found everything, because obviously every time we go back, and we found this the second time, because it was September, the light was very low, much kind of different, the shadows are different and the effect is different. So undoubtedly, if someone went around and looked again, they would find other things. But we systematically went around every wall and looked at every single piece and made a note of every stone of any interest with anything interesting on it. And that's just a picture taken by Ethan, who was one of the volunteers, showing us at work. The people listening to what I'm saying, which is dangerous. And so we found 20 different stones with some sort of carving or work that made them kind of interest. A lot of varying different things. While we went round, next one, we made a little record sheet for each stone. The idea of this project isn't, because it's only very limited in scope, it's not to produce a big long report. All we're going to produce is effectively an archive of material, so all this stuff will be available. It'll go to the archives and it'll form part of a general resource that can be used. But for every single stone we produced a fairly basic record sheet with a little sketch, some dimensions, some other information, which is the sort of standard thing that you would do as an archaeologist. You try and make it systematic and organised as best you can. And the next one. And we produced a plan of the building, very, very basic external plan at scale of about 1 to 100, I think it was. And on that we've marked all the features of interest and where all the stones were in plan. So this is the first time that's been done, really, because obviously there's a lot of things that have been mentioned but not been identified exactly where they are. So what did we find in the 20 things? Well, nothing revolutionary, but still interesting in its own right. So obviously we found things that were already known about, which is the next one. That's as part of this project, I should have mentioned as well. Because of the way technology works now, what you can do with photographs, I went around and took a whole series of photographs of the outside as well, especially because it's quite a nice sunny day. And with modern technology, you can actually produce what's called rectified images, which basically means a perfectly flat, perfectly straight images that you can draw directly onto. And so these are the images, and then my colleagues just draw around in detail, and that's basically detail you want. So again, really the point of doing that isn't because we're going to spend ages looking at every single bit of building and all the phasing of it, but it means that in the future those images are now available for someone who wants to have a look at it in more detail and work various things out. It's quite nice.
It's also,
yeah. 3D, yeah, also that also makes a 3D model that you can basically spin around, which is quite nice and sort of useful in some way. Mm-hmm. That's the which side is that? North side, isn't it? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Right, next one. No, that's the my step. Mm-hmm. And south side. Right. Mm-hmm. So the 20 stones we found, obviously quite a few ones that we're already known about, and these are the two that you've seen pictures of already several times today. That's just a photograph that we took while we're there, and obviously it's worthwhile taking a photograph at different times of these stones, even the well-known ones, because it shows any differences in the erosion, how much they've changed over time. Obviously they were known about. Next one. We've managed to identify where at least two of the masonry marks in that earlier description are. This one is sort of like a slightly wonky swastika style, and that one is a sort of loop of a line. They're both in, I think, that window there in the outside jams, we can see them as you go around, which is nice because they've not been, previously weren't relocated. Some of the marks that we found absolutely old Bob hugely interesting. Next one. Well, the other thing is that, of course, a lot of the masons would have worked their way around from one site to another, so probably you're going to find the same marks on different buildings. And somebody, a chap called Blake Tyson, who died recently, has done quite a lot of work looking at masons and actually found, not medieval ones, but later on, found the indentures for masons where they actually put their mark on the indenture to demonstrate that's their mark. So, and I think the theory is that in some cases the mark's passed down from father to son, so you took on your father's mark, you know, carried on using or a version of it anyway. So it wouldn't be at all surprising if these same marks were found elsewhere, and that would mean, you know, you could see the same masons have moved from one side to another. One of the less interesting marks, there's weirdly two benchmarks on the church. Not quite sure why they felt the need to put two benchmarks on the church. They're on the same corner as well, they're on that northeast corner on different sides. Again, the marks are part of the history of the building, so we recorded them, even though they're not hugely exciting. Another ones that are interesting but not necessarily that old. Next one. There's quite a few pieces of graffiti marked in them or scratched into them. This is in that side again next to that door. There's a whole panel of graffiti there. And then far at east end, very, very high up, it's actually on its side there. I've turned it round in the photograph. There's a graffiti section on a stone. And I think that's the right way up. I think it's something in an 18 something, so someone and a date. That's obviously been reused from somewhere else because it's on its side, it's cut in half, it's high up in the east end above the window. So yeah, it's just another random piece. It's difficult to see very well, it's quite a long way up, you can't get to it. And then there's a bit more, this is slightly earlier, some quite nice sections here. Can't see them very well in there, but I think that was 1841 and possibly 1852, I forget now what it says, and that's 18 something. But they're quite nicely carved, but obviously the carved things are a bit older than medieval window surrounds. Which has probably been moved anyway, because that's in the section that was rebuilt, so that's where the windows are missized. A lot of the windows, although they're medieval style, kind of like remodeled 1930s ones that were recarved when they did the work in the 30s, there's one or two in that side that are the original stonework that's just been reset in the new wall. Right, next one. But there are some bits that are definitely more interesting and probably medieval or maybe even earlier. This piece is in the west end, which you can see as you go out. And it looks like it's a moulded, can't really see very well in there, it's got all these mouldings around it. And it's probably a section of a the window arch or a door jamb sideways on, if you imagine that end on, from a carved doorway or window arch. So it's probably medieval, but it's been reused in the end wall on its end, if you see what I mean, sort of sat end on into the wall. Difficult to date, but you know, it's gonna be 12th, 13th, 14th century or something like that, maybe. Next one. In the south side at this end, there's these two reused, this is all the 1930s rebuild, there's these two very, very narrow window tops, and rudimentary, very early narrow windows. They're the lintels from two of these very, very small, narrow windows, probably from the 11th or 12th century church, that have been taken out, and obviously on the spot, they're interesting, not too good to throw away. So they just put them over this door to form sort of nice decorative features. Otherwise, I said to Jan at the time, the door, window tops like that, this kind of very narrow, rounded top, begin in the Roman period, and you find things like that on Roman sites as well, right through really. Now, every time I say it in Roman to Jan, she gets very excited, getting carried away. I'm not saying they're Roman, but they're, you know, that, if you found that on a Roman site, it wouldn't be amazing, but it's a very, very simple type of arch to carry on for a long time. Next one. This is probably the most interesting one in some ways, which is underneath the window in the far corner on there. And I only just realised that Robert mentions it in his book. It's almost certainly medieval. I'm not quite personally sure what it is. What jumps out is that it's the same stone as all the arches in this aisle, basically. This pale and yellowy sandstone, which is not the normal kind of red sandstone you find around here. Robert says it's similar to a cross of Keswick, I think, so I need to look that one up. But it's been moved into that position. That's not its original position. It's moved there quite late. Apparently it was found in the 1930s work as well. But you'll see it underneath that window over there. There's other more enigmatic marks, shall we say. They're all fairly enigmatic, but there's other even more enigmatic ones. You've got the next one.
I think that's quite
enigmatic. Well, that's quite enigmatic.
But
yeah.
Is it an orb?
Well, I always thought, yeah.
Well,
I always thought it's on its side, and I think it should be that way up, and I think that's an orb with a cross on the top.
Within, well, I
suspect that's part of the bigger thing that goes round, but I'm not sure. Yeah, I couldn't find a good example.
I've got your body turned.
Yeah. But then there's this one, which is just marked with a cross and two lines, almost like the new one, but very, very basic, and very, very simple. Now, how much of that is deliberate, or how much of that is just natural? You do get a lot of marks in rocks carved by stuff that's been sat in glaciers, basically, and moving along very slowly, and has lines carved across it by glacial action. So it's possible that's all that is, but it just looks a bit too deliberate, because all these lines are kind of parallel to each other, and they're very even, these crosses. So, again, I wouldn't like to say what that is. You know, it's a shame it's only a small part. Is it Roman numerals, XII? Don't know. A bit difficult to say, though. It's only quite small as well, and that's a 20 centimetre scale, so it's not huge. Next one. This one's quite interesting. We didn't notice this one initially. I think we spotted it the second time around, or I didn't really know how interesting it was. And it's right in the bottom of the east end. It's in the plinth that was on the bottom of the wall. And it's this kind of cross pattern across the stonework. Which is something, I think I said at the time, it is something you see on Roman sites. It's what's called cross broaching. And it's a way they just finish stonework and they put a crisscross pattern across it to help it basically grip onto other stones. And it's like just a way of finishing it. Or is it potentially a piece of that interlaced pattern that we saw on the cross and it's just been hacked off to make a plinth at the back? Don't know, it's a bit unusual, that one. It stands out as very obviously different than everything else as well. And it's just hiding away at the bottom of the wall at the back. And then just as I was finishing, I was just taking some final photographs, and then I spotted this last one, I think I just mentioned it as we were going, which I don't know how well you can see that, but that piece there has a big carved arc in it, and that's all pecked out, it's quite early. It's annoying because it's only right at the end of the stone, that's the edge of the stone there. There's this great big carved arch in it. Not sure what that is. Again, that's in the north side, just up here. But it's definitely, it's obviously deliberate, it's not an accident, that. So, yeah, you can have fun spinning these pictures around and seeing what they look like from different angles, but you don't get any real answers. So the you got the next one. The I mentioned cross hatching, and I just happened to be doing some work at Carlisle Castle a few weeks ago. And these are pieces of cross hatched stone reused in Carlisle Castle, almost certainly Roman in date, that just been reused from the forts at Carlisle. Obviously, Carlisle Castle is full of reused Roman stone with statues up on the forts. But you know, it's not dissimilar to the other pieces in that end wall if you look at it. So you know, it's certainly of interest. We didn't find any stones that revolutionised our understanding of the building exactly, but certainly they're of interest, and inevitably it raises more questions than it provides answers. There's quite a lot of things there which you know, they jump out of being interesting, but we can't say enough about them as they stand by themselves, which is not uncommon. But what the project has allowed us to do is produce these drawings from the building based on the photographs, which allow us to show some interpretation of what's going on. And what's interesting is that's that end of the chancel, and you can actually see where the rebuild of the 1930s was all around it. And actually some of the central part is apparently the original building, and they actually just enlarged the whole thing that way. So these two walls were taken out in that direction, but part of the centre was actually left in intact. And we've marked every single marked stone on these drawings as well. So that's all the numbers. That's the cross hatch one there. And then that's allowed us to mark on various other things. That's the one intact of the window, you know, the little window head sort of shows that in that side. That's the one that's still intact on this side, which is the same style. But every little piece of stone is marked, and we put some notes in. There's a blocked up opening just beyond the porch on that side that we've marked on as well. Next one. And then obviously that's showing the big archway and the west end, which, as Robert mentioned, there's some debate about whether that means there was a tower at that end. I mean, it seems entirely plausible that that's going to a tower that stood on that end at some point. Towers were often added to churches later on and not necessarily original features, but there's no record. I don't think there's any record of a tower. Not anything written down anyway. There's no pictures of a tower. So if there was a tower there, it must have been taken down at a very early date, long before anyone could record it. And that's just showing the south side with the windows behind that monument blocked up. There's been a lot of rebuilding in there, and a lot of rebuilding underneath that window as well. That's the door, our window heads, and lots of other bits and pieces as well. Next one. So what I'd said as well to Jan about doing this day to day was I'll just throw out a few ideas about what might have been going on in Milham in the kind of what we call the early medieval period, i.e. before the Norman conquest, after the end of the Roman period, which is what everyone traditionally called the Dark Ages. We don't really call it the Dark Ages anymore, although we might as well in this part of the world, but we still know very little about what's going on. All we know for certain, what we do know for certain, is that there was an earlier pre-Norman activity on this site. The cross fragments from the that end of the building, that end of the church, still demonstrate there was something pre-Norman going on here. So I mean, you know, really before 1092 in this area, but probably 9th, 10th, 11th century, there was some sort of religious site, Christian site, you know, a church or something similar at that point. And I think we shouldn't really abandon any idea that the Antef stone is Roman, because I think it's probably more likely something like this. This is a much bigger block, as you can see. This is an early medieval inscription from Wales, this one. Mm. It's called the Porius Stone, northwest Wales, 5th to 6th century AD. And these were quite commonplace in quite a lot of areas of Wales, northern England and Scotland. And they're basically like the follow-on from the Roman Empire. So they're still trying to use Roman script, they're still writing in Latin, but it's very debased, it's not very good quality. You know, you can see how rough the letters are compared to a really good Roman inscription. But they're still using Latin, and you have to remember that in this part of the world, as well as lots of other areas, after the Roman conquest, people didn't just disappear, and they didn't just give up on... They'd become Christians by that point. They didn't give up on Christianity. They remained Christians, And a lot of the time they saw themselves as the continuation of the Roman Empire, effectively. And certainly well until the 7th century, they saw themselves as a continuation of that Roman way of life. They were trying to live that Roman way of life, but without all the money and without the army and without all the rest of it. And so these kind of inscriptions you find in quite a lot of places are basically a very debased version of Latin, a very, very basic version. And I think the Antef stone is effectively a piece of one of these. Well, they do have that. This is a very basic one, but you do get that as well, that little details, yeah. I mean, that's the thing, they're still trying to write in the style of a Roman inscription, but it's not quite as good as a really good Roman inscription. Have you got the next one? This is a very famous one. This is called the Latinus Stone from Whittle, which many people have heard of, I'm sure, or certainly heard of Whittle. And again, it's a very, very debased script. More often than not, these stones are set up at memorials of somebody who's died. They have a very, very similar range of texts. Actually, we go back to the last one. That's not quite here. Well, they often contain the same element, hic and hyacit, which basically, I believe, well, my Latin doesn't make up, but I think it means here lies or here is buried. And then it will be usually start with hic hyacit and then somebody's name, and it will usually say who was something or other, the son of somebody or other. And this stone was put up by so-and-so, very much like the Roman inscription. But they're more often than not put up for members of the religious community. So the Latin stone of Whittle, I think, is thought to have been put up for somebody who was a priest in that community. I'm trying to find images online. It's not very easy to find good images online. You can just pinch very quickly. But I found a few. And the next one is another one from Wales. And that, I think, is a slightly more useful example, because what's interesting about that one is they're often sideways on. If you imagine that stone there as part of a bigger pillar, the Antef is just part of a bigger section, and what we've lost is all the rest of it. And the other thing that, as we noticed about Collingwood's interpretation, which is that it is curante Flavio, there's no space for the L of Flavio, there's nothing after that. Whereas a lot of these inscriptions along the walls do just end midway through a word and then carry on the next line. They don't have an obvious point when they stop. So unless we can work out what Antef means in the context of one of these stones, which maybe is more reasonable, we're going to struggle a bit. So I think, go to the next one. I suspect that what was going on at Millenbeck was that we had an early post-Roman Christian site which continued in use well into the Norse period and then became the site of the parish church, which is not uncommon, happening in a lot of places at this time. There's a few other interesting clues about the topography of the site. Obviously we know Millen Church and Castle's on quite an obvious island of grazed lands, but there's some quite interesting earthworks in this lower area here, coming down there, and there's quite noticeable earthwork running through that field there. And actually what you get is quite an interesting looking kind of enclosure going around, which is very much in the style of an early medieval monastic site, or something of that type. I'd be interested to know if there's any evidence for what these banks were created by, if it's anything more recent or not. Another thing, we've got the next one. The churchyard was originally quite smaller. If you go back again, you see that line, follow that line there, that's that line there. And what you seem to have is an earlier churchyard that's almost oval or circular, which again is a good sign of an early churchyard. A lot of these sites were circular or oval shaped churchyards, with an outer enclosure that came around the outside, and they worked in the same way that a medieval monastery works, which is you have an inner precinct and an outer precinct, and you have bits and pieces of activity, the important core stuff going on the inner precinct, and the other activities going on the outer precinct. And it's interesting as well that you look at how the castle has been built, it's actually plonked over the top, I would say, of where this obvious outline would be, if you follow that logic around, the castle ditch has effectively just been plonked on top of it, which again means that this has been much earlier, because it's gone well out of use by the time castle was built, or whenever the castle was built. So that to me is quite interesting. And another thing that I've forgotten about, actually, that's mentioned in Robert's book, is that one of the fields, I don't know if it's this field here, was called, was historically known as Children's Field. And is it that one over there? Is it one behind the school?
Yeah, the school, yeah.
So it's over here, basically, inside that ditch. And children has always been interpreted as coming from Gaelic, Kildrum, which means hill of the chapel, or hill, sorry, ridge of the chapel, or even ridge of the cell. Kill is more like monastic cell, really. You find it all over Scotland, places called Kill this and Kill that, and Ireland as well. And obviously a lot of these earlier sites, they were more like monastic, a group of monastic cells clustered around a sort of church building with a lot of ancillary activities going on as well. And the fact that you've got a Gaelic place name suggests that you've got either, it was already there when Gaelic speaking Vikings turned up. A lot of the Vikings who turned up in this area, forget the idea about rampaging lunatics, looting churches and all that kind of stuff. A lot of them were actually fleeing from Ireland, basically as refugees. And they have Irish wives and Irish children, because they've gone to Ireland first, settled down in Ireland, built a great big city in Dublin, then got kicked out by the rulers of Dublin, who thought booted them all out in 902. So a lot of them came to this part of the world. And a lot of the Irish place names, that the Irish or Gaelic element place names you find in this area, were probably coined when Vikings came over with their Irish wives and children and speaking Irish, or Gaelic rather, and Norse. So you get this weird combination of people who were supposedly Norse, who were speaking Gaelic, or at least understand Gaelic, and have Gaelic wives and Gaelic children and all the rest of it. So you get this very, very complicated picture of, it's not just this idea of, you know, it's ironic that a lot of the kind of Aryan, the sort of Aryan supremacy idea about blonde-haired Scandinavians and Vikings, by the time they come to this part of the world, they've all virtually married in Ireland. They're probably not blonde anymore. They'll come over to this area and settle down over here. And just to give you some other examples, because the next one and the next one. Yeah, next one. This is the monastery at Iona, which is very, very famous. Early medieval monastery set up in the, I don't know what century, very, very early. But notice, very large, absolutely closed ditch. I'm right around the whole site, with all these little bits and pieces of activity inside it, the main church, with all the little chapels and other buildings inside it. And another very, very famous site. So I'm not suggesting Billum was anything like this. No. Or the next one. This is Whittle. Again, suggested out of enclosure, suggested in the enclosure, church in the middle, burials, settlements, buildings, all kinds of things. And I suspect that it's entirely plausible that something on that sort of type, not on this sort of scale, so these very, very famous, well-established sites, was happening at Milan, probably from the 5th, 6th century. But obviously we haven't got the evidence, because no one's ever dug anything to find any of it. So I'm kind of hoping if we go back a couple of slides, go back like 4, get that one. It would be nice, as part of a future project, potentially to look at these earthworks if we can. Maybe to look where that bank there is, and maybe to look at this bank here, and see if there's any evidence for what's actually going on some of these sites. I mean, recent excavation at Workington, where the church there had a lot of work done after it burned down, they found a substantial ditch forming part of the early enclosure, and then and quite a lot of North period activity and slightly later stuff. Something on a similar sort of form, but you know, similar sort of scale. So I think there's a lot more potential there than you know, the Antestone, if we could definitely say it's Roman, great. But I don't think it is. I think it's more interesting. I think it points to this site being used for another 400 years before what we thought it was. As a religious Christian site, so that's kind of interesting in its own right. The other thing to remember as well is that a lot of these sites where, because there was a lot of work at Dacre, where there was an early monastery, which is mentioned by Bede, and mentioned in a few other documents, and it was excavated in the 1980s, it's only just been published, and they had all sorts of stuff there. But what you find a lot of these early sites that have 5th, 6th, 7th century, you know, monasteries or whatever you want to call them, there's quite a lot of Roman stuff knocking about as well. And you have to remember that in the 5th century, so that's the 400s AD, It's entirely possible you could have a 100-year-old coin, just as an heirloom. That would be like you and I own Victorian plates in my house. They're 150 years old. So if it's AD 450 and you own a 100-year-old coin, that's from the AD 350, so in the end of the Roman period. So a lot of these sites, there were old bits of Romans sort of knocking about as heirlooms or whatever, and for whatever reason, and they do turn up. Not saying there's nothing Roman here as well, it's entirely possible there was something Roman here as well. But, you know, you've got that continuation, and that's what's so interesting about it. Like John said at the beginning, we've got evidence for crop marks that are maybe 6,000 years old, right through, pretty much non-stop occupation all the way right through to now, which is, you know, fantastic. And there's not many places where you can actually say that. In fact, when you think about it, even a lot of the Roman cities, Carlisle is one of the few in the country where you've got actual activity right through, non-stop all the way through. And so, you know, we've got similar kind of stuff going on, but on a much smaller scale. Straight towards Wallathwaite, which Wallathwaite, the word means clearing at the ford, which is the obvious place where they'd be a ford. And there's a church with a lot of early medieval crosses there. So they're coming down there, across the river, and down straight down here. So it all kind of makes a lot of sense, really. But it's proven anything, that's the problem. And even if you dug that thing and found the track, unless you can date it, you still don't know what it is. So, and you know, a lot of Roman roads are not classic Roman roads with ditches and big surfaces. Well, I assume that's medieval, but I don't know. Yeah. But, you know, Nelson will be working that way from early on. I mean, another point of interest, Whittle, when they dug Whittle in the 80s, and he's published in this enormous big book, there were huge, not huge, but fairly substantial heaps of hematite lying about on the site in 7th and 8th century contexts. So there were metalworking within this monastic site, they were doing metalworking, because a lot of these monastic sites, they were doing all sorts, crafts and activities and all kinds of things. But they've got hematite. But there's no hematite in Whittle. There's no hematite in Ireland. There's no hematite in Scotland. I think there might be a tiny bit. The obvious place the hematite is coming from is the west coast of Cumbria, which is a sure hop on a boat to Whittle. But you forget, Whittle is only up there. It's not very far away, you know. And the trouble is now we've become so separated by the idea of England and Scotland. Completely different. It's 100,000 miles between. But it's not by boat. It's a short hop from here to Whittle. So somebody was mining iron ore, probably in this part of the world, in the 7th or 8th century, and shipping it to Whittle. But who's organising that? It's not just being done by any old random person, a couple of shovels and a dog and a donkey, is it? It's being done by an organised political whatever that's organising that. And it's entirely possible that these religious groups, entities, even then were organised bunches with industrial aspects who controlled lands, and we're doing all kinds of, in the same way that later on Furness Abbey had sheep farms and mines and, you know, all this kind of stuff. It's exactly the same. They weren't stupid, they were making use of the resources and the controls. So it's entirely possible that somebody here was in contact with Whittle and was organising the shipment of iron ore from this area to Whittle and probably getting things back in return. But, you know, who knows? Want to find a piece of lead with a little orders. Two boats of iron ore, two, so and so. But, you know, there's so much potential, I think, potentially, going on there. It's fascinating, really. So. And you can't forget about the Ravenloft, of course, up the coast was almost certainly a port used by the in the Roman period, probably carried on being a port afterwards, was almost certainly used to shifting up and down the Irish Sea coast, you know, all over the place, and then probably carried on as a useful port long after that. And then drink means, you know, drag, where you drag boats up onto the shore, you know, from an early date, and so there's probably quite a lot of that going on. stones to, not very interested in stones, to like do the excitement.